This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we'll visit with former Congressman Bob Livingston of Louisiana. He served Louisiana's 1st Congressional District for 22 years. He resigned on December 19, 1998, the day of the Bill Clinton impeachment in the U.S. House. Livingston voted for all four articles of impeachment, then resigned himself after admitting that he was involved in an adulterous affair. He'll talk about his varied career. He was a whisker away from becoming the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives. And in 1987, he ran third in a wild governor's race. We'll talk with Bob Livingston, whose memoir is coming soon, The Windmill Chaser. Also, Adam Sharp, former top aide to U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu. Adam Sharp is now the head, the president of the American Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster, and thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And we begin the week with a special guest indeed, former U.S. Congressman Bob Livingston of Louisiana. He was a powerhouse on Capitol Hill for a couple of decades, and he is writing his memoir that will be available for public consumption on September 11th. In fact, it's already in the can, and you've written every word, and it's good to see you, Congressman Livingston.
No ghostwriters here, Jim. It's great to be back with you. It's a little different perspective than I had back when I was in Congress, but I'm now old enough to look back on things and reflect on them.
You just turned 75 years old.
I did.
You look great.
Thank you.
But you've led a full life.
We've had a lot of fun. I've had the good fortune of having three good careers. One, I was a criminal prosecutor and lawyer for a number of years, 9 years total. And then I was a congressman for 22 years, and I've been a lobbyist, which is not a four-letter word, a fairly successful lobbyist with my own firm for the last almost 20 years.
Most people probably don't know it, but you were born in Colorado.
I was born in Colorado Springs, and I always say I made a career decision to move to New Orleans when I was 6 years old.
It worked out pretty well for you in New Orleans. Getting out of law school, your first boss was a fellow named David Treen.
Was indeed. I didn't know him. I wasn't even sure I was going to practice law. I was married with one kid, another one pretty well on the way, and just scanned the bulletin board toward the end of the senior year and noticed that this fellow, Dave Treen, who had run for Congress on at least two occasions and was a Republican, was looking for an associate. One thing led to another, and I ended up going to work for Dave Treen for 2 years in his law firm. He later ran and became the first Republican congressman in the state of Louisiana, and then the first Republican governor in the state of Louisiana. He was a mentor of mine, and after Henson Moore got elected in 1974, 2 years after Dave, Henson represented this area in the Baton Rouge area. Mm-hmm. Then I ran in 1976, and that was after having worked for the U.S. Attorney's Office, the District Attorney's Office, and the Louisiana Attorney General's Office, Billy Gust. I had a resume, and I ended up running, and I got beat in 1976, and a fellow that beat me was nice enough to go to prison, and I had another shot at it and got elected in 1977.
Rick Tonry went to prison, and Bob Livingston was in Congress for the next 22 years. And you trace your ancestors to the founders of the country.
Well, that was the more successful members of my family. Yeah, they go back to about the middle of the 17th century, 1600s. And a lot of them were very successful. In fact, one of them, Edward Livingston, actually ended up coming to Louisiana and held the same seat that I held, the first district of Louisiana.
And Philip Livingston, he was a signer of the Declaration of Independence, is that right?
A. Philip, yes. He was the son of another Philip from whom I am directly descended.
Well, the book that Bob Livingston has written, and every word is his, The Windmill Chaser, Triumphs and Less in American Politics. And as we do this program on the 6th, tomorrow, for example, is the birthday of your former nemesis, Edwin Edwards. He'll be 91. But he's never written his own personal story. Leo Honeycutt wrote it for him. Most people would go that route. Why did you decide to write every word?
Well, first of all, I would say that Edwin could have written his own. You know, he's a very bright guy and very capable, and he's had a remarkable career. I just have never thought much about ghostwriters. I have a story to tell. I think I have a sense of humor. I've had a lot of interesting experiences, and I didn't think that anybody else could tell them better than I could.
Well, you have had a full career, and 10 years into your tenure in Congress, you decided you'd like to be governor of Louisiana, following your mentor, David Treen. That was the one race you lost after being elected to Congress, and people may not remember, but Bob Livingston did finish third with about 20% of the votes. You had the unfortunate happening of the stock market crash the week of the election, the Monday before, and you were the only Republican running then. That's another thing that's changed in Louisiana, is that in 1987 it was Edwards, Romer, Tozan, and Jim Brown, all of whom were Democrats. You were the lone Republican. What do you recall about that race, and how much of a disappointment was it that you didn't get the governorship?
All good questions. By then, I'd had 10 good years in the United States Congress, and I really loved being in Congress the whole time I was there. And fortunately, the governor's race was the off-year election. Had it been on the same time as the congressional election, I probably wouldn't have run. When I ran for Congress, I had it in my gut. I knew I really wanted to be a United States congressman. When I ran for governor, I thought I wanted to be governor, but I had not had any statewide political background. I hadn't been in the state legislature. Frankly, I think it was an intellectual exercise rather than an emotional one. I ran first because I was the only Republican. I ran first throughout the entire year that I was running until the last 3 to 4 weeks. We had a couple of debates. I did okay in one, but it didn't do too well in the other. I think I had a lapse of thought and just couldn't reach my words. And frankly, that hurt me. And then Buddy Romer went around to all of the editors of all of the major papers in the state. Romer had been running fifth out of nine. We lost Butch Baum, if you recall, who crashed his plane in Arkansas because I guess he fell asleep at the switch when he was piloting his own plane. But Buddy Romer had been running fifth, had no organization, had no not much of anything. Going for him, but he had an ability to snow anybody he talked to, and he convinced the editors that he would be a better governor than I would. So we knew that Edwin Edwards was going to run second. By that time, he'd had two terms in, and he was doing well. He'd had some indictment, some problems with hospital certificates, and we knew that he wasn't going to win that year. But he was going to run second. I was first. Romer was fifth. After the editorial newspapers all came out at the same time, then Romer zoomed up to first in the last couple of weeks, and I was knocked to third. Billy Tazan thought he was going to be governor his whole life, and he came
fourth.
He came in fourth, and but I ended up running first. I came out in the final election in the third, and how did I feel about it when it was over? Probably a little sense of relief. I went back to Congress and had another great 10, 12 years, and I've never had any regrets about the way it turned out.
And in Congress, and you write about it in the book, you served with some giants, both in the House and the presidents. You were there for all 8 years of Ronald Wilson Reagan. When you came in, though, Jimmy Carter was the president of the United States.
Jimmy Carter was president. He wasn't a terribly successful president, but I served. I came in after about 6-8 months after he was sworn in, served with him. He's a very nice guy. Then Ronald Reagan, I just loved serving with Reagan, under Reagan, going to the White House with the whip team headed by Trent Lott. all the George W. Bush, H.W., and then all of the successors. I had probably enjoyed the Reagan years best, but I enjoyed them all, and I really felt like I could do something for my constituents. I served in the minority for 17 years. Republicans didn't take the majority until 1994 and 5. And until then, I knew that I had to deliver for my mm-hmm. constituents. So I worked hard for my constituents, whoever they were. I just delivered for them. And I ended up getting reelected pretty darn easily over the years. And I did it in the minority, and I did it in the majority when I was chairman of the Appropriations Committee.
Big job. And before you got there, you spent many years in the House with Tip O'Neill as the speaker from the rival party. He was a larger-than-life character.
Tip was just a great guy. He swore me in, and I was of a different party than he was, and we had political differences, but I really liked him, and I liked serving with him. He was a character, a good old Irish Paul, mm-hmm. and you couldn't not like Tip O'Neill. In fact, the stories always have been that Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill just got along great.
And then in 1994, the Republicans gained control of the House, the contract with America. That was a big moment.
I helped draw that up. I was in on the conception, although it was definitely the idea of Newt Gingrich and Dick Armey who dreamed up the contract with America, but I wrote the defense plank. And that got us elected. But insofar as the House is concerned, for the first time in 40 years.
We're visiting with Congressman Bob Livingston. 22 years he served Louisiana in the U.S. House. His memoir coming September 11th, The Windmill Chaser, Triumphs and Less in American Politics. We'll talk more with the Congressman when we return with Talk Louisiana after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster, and we're continuing our conversation with Congressman Bob Livingston. His memoir coming soon is The Windmill Chaser, and he is here talking about his life and times that are all profiled in the book. And as mentioned, he spent 22 years in the U.S. House of Representatives, 11 terms, and when he was 55 years old, he was an eyelash away from being Speaker of the House. I remember all the stories in the New York Times. That was a heady time, wasn't it?
Well, it was. We were engaged in the impeachment of William Jefferson Clinton. It started in early 1998 when Clinton was found to have had problems with a lady by the name of Monica Lewinsky. And at first it was just the talk of some of his past experiences with women. Of course, many had come forward over the years, and the White House, through Ms. Clinton had headed up a bimbo eruption tag team that always put out the fires and attacked the women that were making charges against Bill Clinton. In this day and age of Me Too, I don't know that that would have been as successful, but back then it was very successful. They ended up trying to ruin all the women that were making charges about him. But the situation with Monica Lewinsky kind of rose to the top, became a tough issue for the president to deal with in the latter part of his election, in his time as president. And unfortunately, or fortunately, the fact is he was a fairly successful president. He had learned to deal with a Republican Congress. We were getting stuff done. In fact, with the Republican Congress, we had passed tax reform, we had passed welfare reform, and with my stewardship over the as chairman of the Appropriations Committee, we had balanced the discretionary budget, not the mandatory stuff, but the discretionary budget for the first time in God knows when. So we were having successes. And initially, then Speaker Newt Gingrich says, we're not going to talk about Clinton's problems because he's going to stew in his own ink. That's not for us to worry about. That was the right policy. Unfortunately, he kind of adjusted as time went on, about 3 months later.
Gingrich.
Yeah. Then he wanted to take all the money that we had and put it into anti-Clinton campaigns, attacking him for his other extracurricular activities. That turned out to be a real mistake. And as we got closer to the election, we really thought we were going to pick up about 15 seats. But because of all of the stuff that transpired and because we only directed the people's attention to the Clinton foibles, they forgot that we had balanced the budget. They forgot that we had welfare reform. They forgot that we had tax reform. They forgot all the reasons why they had elected Republicans to the Congress in the first place. And as a result, we didn't win 15 seats. We lost five. And that frustrated the heck out of a lot of members of the Republican conference. Some people were going to run against Newt. I didn't want to. He'd made me chairman of the Appropriations Committee. But when I looked around and started talking to people and realized that he probably couldn't get elected as speaker again because he was the coach for the team that didn't do so well, as within a period of week that I describe in my book, The Windmill Chaser, on a day-to-day basis, I decided to run against him, and I was the candidate, and I was elected by the Republican Conference to be the speaker-elect, which meant that I was going to be the next speaker. But as time went down, I ended up becoming a poster child for Larry Flynt. He had done some background checks on a number of congressmen. He was going to blow the lid off of that. I decided, frankly, that on the day that I was to take over speaker and the first day of the Congress, I didn't want Larry Flynt to have the upper hand. So I called on President Clinton to resign in my final speech. And a lot of the Democrats started screaming, "Well, you resign." I said, "Wait a minute." And as I gave the speech, which again is in my book, I said, "I'm going to call on you, Mr. President, to resign your office because you've disgraced the office, not because of all the sexual peccadilloes, but because he lied under oath and because there were people in jail in the military and in civilian corps who had lied under oath, done exactly what he did, and they were in prison." So I called on him to resign his position as President of the United States. And then I said, "If you're not willing to do it, I'm going to show you how you can do it." And I did.
Any regrets?
No. I did the right thing. It meant that I wasn't going to be speaker. Have I regretted that I wasn't speaker? Sure, because I would have done I could have done a good job. And I think, again, in my book, I lay out how I might have done a better job than some of the people that came in afterwards. But most importantly, there was no choice for me. Everybody gets a deck of cards, and you play the cards, and I got dealt a funny hand, and so I played it. I think I did the right thing. And look, I've been married for 53 years. I've got a wonderful wife. I've got great kids, great grandkids, and even one grandchild, a great grandchild. And I've been very, very fortunate. I got a successful business and wonderful partners in the business. And I look back on it, and could it have been different? Sure. Would I have made a good speaker? Yeah, I think I would have. But that was the way the cookie crumbled. And I think that as time has gone by, Bill Clinton is still being questioned about his activities back then. He was a fairly successful president, had it not been for all his own personal problems. And now he's got to live with Hillary Clinton, who didn't become president. And that may be painful for him, but it's pretty good for me.
Well, we'll get to that. But how difficult was that time for you and your family, though? Here you were on the brink of the job that anybody who's been a House member covets. And you had it. You had it in your grasp, and then you let it go.
Well, that's why I call it the windmill chaser. I've chased top jobs, and I've caught some, and I've lost others. I haven't always succeeded. When I was a prosecutor, I didn't win every case. But have paid for that. It was a painful time afterwards, and I've gotten over it. And life has gone on. I can only say that Would I want to go through that again? No. I had 22 years in Congress that I really, really enjoyed. It was only that last week that I didn't enjoy so much. And by the way, it was not the worst thing that ever happened to me, because about 6 or 8 years later, we lost our second son. And anybody that's lost a child knows that that's the worst thing that can happen to you.
I can tell by your emotions right now you still live with that.
Oh, we live with it every day. I mean, you know, that just, you know, and you expect older people to pass away. We both lost our parents. Bonnie, my wife Bonnie, lost her brother, Dick Robichaud, who was a great orthopedic surgeon right here in Baton Rouge, only about 8-9 months ago. And that's all painful. But when you lose a kid, no, that's different.
As far as what it would have done for Louisiana with you as Speaker, what kind of opportunities did our state miss as a result of what happened?
I think probably a lot, quite a bit. When I was chairman of the appropriations, when I was on the Appropriations Committee initially with Lindy Boggs as my counterpart from New Orleans, who's also on the Appropriations Committee, we did a lot for Louisiana. I think that in my 22 years, I was very constituent service oriented, and I wanted to help my constituents, and I wanted to help my state and city and the nation. And I was successful at it. Had I been Speaker, I would have been more successful, then no doubt about it. But look, it wasn't to happen, and there's not much I could do about it. I regret it. And I don't think that the people that succeeded me did quite the job that they should have either. But it is what it is.
Bob Livingston, the book is The Windmill Chaser, and we'll be back to spend a few more minutes with this exceptional public figure who's been a part of the Louisiana political landscape for more than 4 decades. We're back after this time out on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster, and we're visiting with Congressman Bob Livingston. His memoir, The Windmill Chaser, is coming soon. It'll be available for public consumption on September 11th. And Bob Livingston was in the U.S. House of Representatives from 1977 to 1999, some of the most interesting times in our country's history. What do you think of President Trump?
He is the most unusual person probably to occupy the White House since Lincoln's time. Even beyond Reagan, I like him. I mean, I don't like a lot of the stuff he does. I'm not crazy about his trade policies, and I worry about the implication of them. But basically, he with no experience in politics, with no experience in policy, he has come about his job as a successful businessman who is conservative. I mean, I think his appointments to the Supreme Court and all the courts of appeal and the district benches are just fantastic. I think his deregulation of government and that have just gotten out of control is absolutely imperative and great. What do I think he could work on? He could work on his flamboyant tweets and mm-hmm. some of his processes. Some of his experiences have been less attractive than the average president, but he's not an average president. And I consider most of the stuff that you read about on a day-to-day basis, but just to be noise. I look at what is he doing, and I think he's making America great again, to use a phrase. I think he's really working hard to make this country better than it was when Obama left it. And in only a year and a half, he's had amazing success. So I'm a Trump supporter.
Do you think the probe by Robert Mueller is going anywhere?
No, I don't. I have not yet seen any evidence of Russian collusion or Russian conspiracy or any of that kind of stuff. I think had it existed, we'd all be reading about it. We'd be listening to about it. I think, I worked for the Department of Justice when I was an assistant U.S. attorney back in the early 70s. I was proud of the Department of Justice. I look at what some of these guys at the top of the FBI and in the Justice Department are doing today. And they were trying to slant this thing toward Hillary Clinton. They thought she was going to win. But when they didn't win, they have attacked Donald Trump. And I just really think that they have exceeded their charter, and they've got to be reined in. These are bad people. And they are not the dispassionate, objective, law and order types of people that I was proud to serve way back 40 years ago.
Now, the Livingston Group, your lobbying firm, has done very well and has represented some companies, some countries abroad, primarily countries. And one of the things that you take some credit for is the approval of the Morocco-U.S. Free Trade Agreement. The president has caused some concern about these tariffs. What do you think, and about some of his trade policies? What do you think of these?
I think that we have to hope that they're short-term trade policies versus long-term trade policies. There's a key word that he uses from time to time called reciprocity. And basically what it means is if you hurt our products, we're going to hurt yours. And that's his whole approach. I think that his goal is legitimate. I think in the best of all worlds, everybody ought to have free and fair trade, where both sides are treated equally. I think he makes a good point that it hasn't really worked out that way in the last 30 or 40 years, and he's trying to fix it. But I'm not positive that his fixes are going to work, and I hope they do.
You have rubbed shoulders with the giants of public life, the highest levels of our government. Before we go, a few observations, maybe a little word association. Ronald Reagan.
Fantastic. I just remember being with him, standing next to him and slapping him on the shoulder. He used to chop wood. He was like a brick wall. I mean, he might as well slap a brick wall and you'd get the same impact. But he was a thoughtful, nice man who really worked a lot harder, and it was a lot smarter than the press gave him credit for way back when. But most importantly, he was great for the nation. I think fundamentally he collapsed the Soviet Empire, and of that I am proud to have been a teammate of his.
Bill Clinton.
A very capable, very smart man, and he was smart enough to know that his socialistic policies of the first 2 years in his office weren't working, and when Republicans came in, or before they came in, he said the era of big government is now over, and he started cutting back and telling his people to cut back, and he had a good presidency were it not for his personal problems. So I admire Bill Clinton in his abilities. He's probably one of the best politicians we've ever had in modern times, but he had other problems.
David Treen.
Dave Treen was the nicest guy you ever want to know. He was very, very bright. He was Order of the Coif at Tulane Law School, which is right at the top of his class. He was very conservative, but genuine, just a genuine good man, but he couldn't make a decision. He would be so deliberative, and Edwin Edwards said he took an hour and a half to watch 60 Minutes. Unfortunately, that turned out to be true, and he only won a single election. He didn't get the second election to back it up.
Edwin Edwards.
Edwin Edwards, again, a very, very bright guy, didn't drink or smoke. I think he was the template for Bill Clinton. I really think that Bill Clinton watched Edwin Edwards and said, I want to be like that, because they were really very, very similar people, very capable, very charismatic, worked hard. If I called him, I know that I'd get a call within 24 hours. But he had issues with his ethics, I guess. He was charged once with hospital certificates, messing those up, and then ultimately convicted with gambling issues. But I have to admire the way when he got sentenced, and I didn't particularly like that trial, frankly, but when he got convicted and sentenced, he took his time like a man. He went and did it, came back, married a woman much younger than he, has a whole new family. I mean, you know, what's not to like? He's really an attractive Louisiana character.
David Duke.
I don't want to talk about him. I mean, that's not the high point of Louisiana politics. David Duke did get elected to the state legislature one time, but he ran for a lot of other things, and I guess he could have gotten elected, and that would have been really unfortunate.
Some things people don't know about you, those who've seen you, you're a tall man, 6 foot.
Used to be 6'4" and a half. I think in my old age, I'm shrinking a little bit.
Karate. You're into karate, aren't you?
I did do that for a number of years. My good friend, Master June Ree, would teach a lot of us on Capitol Hill. And I got the black belt, but Master Ree just passed away this last year. What a great guy.
Do you like Washington?
No, I like Louisiana. And I keep thinking, well, one of these days I'm going to get back. But I went to Washington thinking I was staying 4 to 6 years. I've been there for 41, almost 42 years. It's a living. There are lots of attractions in Washington. There's something there for everybody, and so much history, and so much, so many great museums and stuff. And the Capitol is fabulous. I can see the Capitol out of my window. From my office today. It's only about 3 blocks away. And that's still thrilling.
You grew up a few blocks from Tulane. What do you think of New Orleans?
Well, New Orleans is a classic town. Some people say it's the most European town of any city in the United States. There's so many attractions. The best food, the best much of the best culture, certainly the best music. It's a fun place to be, and I've got kids and grandkids there. I think the city often lacks in degrees of leadership, and I'd like to see that improved. I'm not a big fan of taking down your history and losing our statues. I mean, it was our history. You can't just rewrite history.
Congressman Bob Livingston writes about his history and our history in The Windmill Chaser, coming soon. It'll be a great read, I'm sure. And he wrote every word. There was no ghostwriter here. And we thank you for your service to our state and our country. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also a veteran of the U.S.
Navy.
1961 to 63.
And my hat's off to everybody who served in uniform. God bless them.
Went in when you were 18?
I went in when I was 18 and stayed till I was 20.
Yeah. Well, thank you, sir.
Thank
it's been
you.
A pleasure. And coming next, we'll hear from Adam Sharp. He is president of the American Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, former top aide to Senator Mary Landrieu, 2004 to 2009. And then he spent 6 years as one of the chief executives at a company called Twitter. Adam Sharp has quite a story, and it began right here with a Louisiana connection. President Trump said over the weekend that a Trump Tower meeting between top campaign aides and a Kremlin-connected lawyer was designed to get information on an opponent, the starkest acknowledgement yet that a statement he dictated last year about that encounter was misleading. Mr. Trump made the comment in a tweet that was intended to be a defense of the June 16, 2016 meeting that his son Donald Trump Jr. played in hosting it. The president claimed that it was totally legal and the sort done all the time in politics. So there obviously was a Russian connection to the Trump campaign. We're back after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster, and thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We're pleased to be joined by Adam Sharp. He served as U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu's top aide, and, well, about a decade ago he left her, but he worked there from 2004 to 2009, first as a spokesman, later as deputy chief of staff, played a key role in the creation of the Senate Centrist Caucus, and Senator Landrieu was a proud member of that group, and they were involved in many major issues, and Adam Sharp did his job well there and has moved on, and now he is a man about town in a new city of New York. From 2010 to 2016, Adam was head of news, government, and elections at Twitter, advising journalists, news organizations, candidates, and government officials in more than 20 nations, and he became the longest-serving member of the company's global media team. And now, he is mentioned, is involved with a new endeavor, and it's, I guess, not so new. He's already been accorded great honors for his work. And tell us about what you're doing right now, Adam Sharp.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me back. It's been a while. I'm currently president and CEO of the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. You probably know us best for the Emmy Awards.
And the 45th Annual Daytime Awards reached the coveted number two trending spot. Ratings were high. And this is despite the fact that it was not televised on a traditional network. How did you accomplish this?
Well, I think it's reflective of the changing face of the television industry today. More and more people are getting their television programming and entertainment from devices other than their TV. They're watching it on their iPhones, on a set-top Apple TV box or something like that. And in fact, for this year's competition, we had more entries to the Daytime Emmys than ever before, largely because of all these new digital streaming shows and a lot of growth in children's programming now that they can produce more and more and not be constrained to just a few hours of Saturday morning, which was the window that children's shows had when I was a kid. And so with the audience finding the shows they're fans of online, it just made sense to honor those shows online as well, and the audience found us there.
Well, Adam Sharp has been referred to as the human embodiment of Twitter, and that's by the New York Times, so a reputable news source. You got involved with this before others, I think even before our president. How has Twitter taken a life of its own, and where do you think it's going?
Well, it has certainly become the core bloodstream of news and politics in our country. When I started at Twitter in 2010, fewer than one in five members of Congress had Twitter accounts. The president at the time, President Obama, wasn't yet on. No members of the cabinet were. Now, essentially every member of Congress. There's a few House members that are still holdouts, but it's 100% of the Senate. Clearly, President Trump has taken it to a new level in terms of his personal use of Twitter to communicate directly with the American people, and in many ways bypassing the traditional media infrastructure that had served as that conduit between voters and their elected officials for the better part of a century. It almost takes us back to what you could consider a more retail form of politics, where voters can hear directly from their candidates, from their president, and ask questions and interact with them. I think that is incredibly powerful. But, of course, we've also seen with the allegations of Russian interference with our elections and so on that removal of media filters can also create vulnerabilities, not just on Twitter, but on Facebook and YouTube and elsewhere that need to be dealt with.
Adam Sharp is with us, and he currently has a huge job as president of the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, but he founded Sharp Things last year to continue providing strategic advice to companies and individuals in the new media, and Twitter is a big part of that, maybe the biggest part. Do you think it's essential now, so let's say for a political candidate, would it be foolish for a candidate to ignore the impact of Twitter?
Yes, full stop. I think that there is an expectation from the electorate that they have that direct conduit to their candidates. And candidates that don't engage on the platform, I think, do it at their peril. There is an attraction to this sense of authenticity, that resistance to the packaging that had become the norm of campaigns. I met a woman in Iowa back in 2016, and I had asked her what she thought of the candidates. And she said, well, they're all liars. I said, okay, but you have to vote for one of them, ma'am. What are you going to vote for? And she said, Donald Trump. And I said, do you think he's a liar? And she said, yes. I said, well, why then him versus Hillary Clinton if you think they're both liars? And she said, and this sentence has stuck with me, Because when Donald Trump lies, he lies from the heart. And to me, that was the one sentence that explained the entire 2016 election, because it came from this place of recognition that a lot of politics is spin and messaging and packaging, and a resistance to that notion of the message we're hearing being concocted around a conference table full of consultants somewhere in Brooklyn, and that good or bad, agree or disagree, the fact that this was coming directly from the candidate's hand to her without any of these filters mattered to her. And I think it matters to other voters. But it's also indicative of how we connect to each other and how we connect to television. A lot of the shows that we honor with the Emmys have gained their popularity because social media has given them a new way to engage with the audience and draw those people in. So they're not just watching on the screen and leaning back, taking the show in, but they're talking back and forth with the cast members. They're asking questions. They're becoming a part of a conversation as opposed to just an audience.
When you got your position at Twitter as a very high position in 2010, did you see this evolving to where it is now?
I don't think I can lay claim to predicting quite the scope of influence that these platforms have attained, but I certainly saw the value of that public conversation, that direct connection, and the ease of it. It's useful to remember that Twitter started as text messaging. You didn't need a smartphone or anything. The reason why it was originally 140 characters was because that was the limit for SMS text messaging. The international standard there was 160 characters, so they said, okay, we reserve some for the username and some for the message. And so there were already reports then of farmers in Central Africa using Twitter to get crop reports on satellite phones. And, you know, at that time, I'd been out of Senator Landrieu's office for only a year or two, still recalling very clearly the experiences down there after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita and the levee breaks and floods that followed, where in many cases terrestrial phone systems went down. Cellular did a bit better, particularly once the companies brought in some satellite towers and so on. And just thinking, how would things have been different in Katrina if there had been a tool like Twitter, an ability to have a distributed message that could get to people even when everything else was failing, when there was a way for people to raise alarm. And certainly as Hurricane Harvey and others have come through, we've seen how that kind of communication helps the response.
Well, as mentioned, your involvement with your new job means that you're involved. One of the major things is this annual Daytime Awards. And as you know, people who are consumers of media, particularly television and other types of media, quite often they have a more intimate attachment to people they see and hear during the day than they do at other times.
Yeah, and I think that daytime television in particular is a very intimate form of television because it is what we're bringing into our homes. Whereas primetime television can sometimes be a little bit more removed, a little bit more of the fantasy where we disconnect from our day-to-day. Mm-hmm. And now you have these things that wind up speaking to current events, the excitement of games of chance, and all these things that tap into our everyday emotions and become this sort of soundtrack to our daily lives. This wound up being, I think, the perfect fit for me because social media has now added that extra layer of connection, that when it is a live event, when it is the news of the day or the big game or a game show on TV, you can be part of the experience and part of the conversation in a way you never could before.
The National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, that's the group that Adam Sharp heads, and you're now involved in schools as well.
Yes, we have a national student television program where students from across the country submit their television productions, and we present that in an awards ceremony hosted by Tom Bergeron. You probably know him Bess is the host of Dancing with the Stars. We do that in October. We also have a national scholarship program, which I'm quite proud to have been the second winner of many years ago, I think 23, 24 years ago now. And that started my connection with this organization, paid for me to go to college, made the introductions for me to have a full-time job in television to pay for my share of tuition for those 4 years. And when you look at the productions that these kids are making, either for the National Student Television Awards or for our scholarships, the level of quality in these productions is just amazing. We last year awarded the Mike Wallace Scholarship, which is the scholarship we give to aspiring television journalists.
And thank you for listening. Pleasure to talk with Adam Sharp. We're back tomorrow, same time, same place. For Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned.